Welcome to the Family Express podcast, where our destination is resilient and connected families. Come aboard with your hosts, marriage and family therapists, Catherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans, to explore the world of emotionally focused family therapy, a model developed by Sue Johnson and colleagues. Together with our guest speakers, our travels will map the EFFT landscape, highlighting lessons learned, shared fears, and the passion and curiosity that bonds our community.
Welcome, everybody. We are excited for today's episode. Our guest today is Kat Austin out of Colorado. Kat, thank you so much for joining us and giving us your time today. We appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So Kat, we're excited for our conversation today, a little bit about neurodivergence and working with neurodivergent clients and families, and maybe the bulk of our conversation around being a parent, having a family of your own, and working with families. So definitely a conversation I'm interested in personally, so I'm excited for today.
Great, me too.
Hey Kat, so good to have you here. I love connecting with you as a fellow mom, and then also as an EFFT therapist. And so what is it like having both of those roles? Is that, how is being an EFFT therapist beneficial to having a family of your own? And where does it get in the way?
Gosh, you know, I started my journey of becoming an EFT therapist when my first son was 6 months old. And so it's been like this interesting journey of my own clinical knowledge of attachment and my parenting and like finding attachment through my son. So it's been formative. I think as far as being an EFFT therapist and being a parent, I think it can be so valuable having our own experience as parents, having our own knowledge of what it's like to be a parent. I think it is so helpful in giving empathy and validation for the really, really, really hard times as a parent. I also think it can evoke immense shame as a parent, right? Like these moments where I have three children, 11, 8, and 5, where I lose it as a mom. Right. And I do something that I yell at them or I get dysregulated or, you know, I just don't have my best moment. And I'm like, oh my God, how in the world can I help families be better families, have more harmony, be more connected, help parents be more responsive when I literally just called my child a jerk? Do you know what I mean? Which we all have those moments. And so it's this balancing of how to work with my own shame and my own knowing that we're all human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I resonate with what you're saying. My body is just like, yes, because I have those moments too. I had them earlier in the car today. And I could hear the tone in my voice. I could hear the clip in my voice. And, I just had that moment of, gotta take a breath, gotta regulate. And I felt that just kind of wash of shame happen. And I gave my husband a look and he put his hand on my hand. Right. And just one of those moments that just came for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It always happens, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering about if you can walk us through maybe how you work with shame with parents when it comes up in the room.
Yeah. Well, first I want to move close to the shame. And I think validation is such an amazing antidote for shame because nobody wants to be left alone in their shame, right? And so really coming close to it and validating it and making such good sense of why shame is here, right? Like shame emerges when something matters and when we want to do something well. And what more than parenting and children do, like our children matter, right, to us so deeply. And we want, I think every parent wants to do it well. And so those places are so important to hold for our clients. And like, sometimes I use self-disclosure, you know, of like, oh man, I really know these places and I can tell you about what happened in the car the other day, and really join in that way of, wow, we are all in this bowl together trying to do parenting and trying to get it right, and no one does. And that seems to oftentimes soothe someone, especially if you're able to metaprocess, what is that like to know about me? How does that land for you? What happens to your shame when you hear that this is a totally natural process for a parent?
Gosh, Kat, thank you so much for just taking us right to the heart of the issue, mm-hmm. like a topic like parenting shame. And I love what you said, that shame happens because something matters. There's shame because it matters. Like, just attaching those together is so helpful. Mm-hmm. And I notice that when people have shame, I so often want to just talk them out of it, reassure them, talk them out of it. Mm-hmm. And yet the picture you've just given is how, if you notice shame, you're not surprised. And you want to make space for it, and you come alongside them, you reassure them, you show them more of yourself, because you know they don't want to be alone. You said no one wants to be alone in their shame. And you even validate them for sharing that part of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's really good stuff.
Yeah, it's important. It can just happen in parenting so easily.
Do you see more of this with parents of neurodivergent children?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, oftentimes if you have a neurodivergent child, not all the time, but most of the time, you will have a neurodivergent parent. And so I think shame can emerge in a couple of different ways, right? Like, if you're a neurotypical parent, and have a neurodivergent child, it can be very hard to understand that their brain works differently and what is necessary to parent that kind of a child. Like, I would describe myself as neurotypical, but two of my three children, the jury's out on the last one, are neurodivergent. One has ADHD, the other one has ADHD and dyslexia. And so I can be somewhat perplexed sometimes at their reactions, at their dysregulation, at the way that their brain thinks, at the kind of support that they need. And so that can be a way that shame gets evoked, I think, in families, and on one half of like not really truly understanding a different brain than yours. And I think the other way that I experience it is when there's neurodivergence and neurodivergence in a parent, right? Where one parent has is neurodivergent, and they're going, oh my gosh, these are the struggles that I gave my kids, or that, you know, because ADHD is specifically so biological, it's like, oh man, I had these same struggles and I don't want my kids to have these same struggles. And so the essence of shame comes up in the neurodivergent parent.
I'm just thinking about that, Kat, because I have heard that from parents. Mm-hmm. And in a way that's reassuring to me that that threat is there. And so that makes the family work a little bit more predictable.
Yeah.
And predictability is always reassuring to me if I have a roadmap of kind of how shame might come up in each of the parents and how it'll look different, that calms my nervous system, right? That feels good to know that's common, and that they're not alone in those experiences mm-hmm. themselves. And if they were to meet other parents, they might experience and hear similar messages from them. That's reassuring for me to hear.
Yeah, absolutely.
You break that down so beautifully, Kat, into some of the different elements we might see in these kinds of families that are carrying neurodivergence, where you might have on the partner level a sense of loss, right, and needing to grieve, and even for the child, right? And then also just understanding the different brain types and needing sort of the psychoeducation that could go along with that, especially if it's different to the brain type that you have. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking it's often just in partnerships, it's hard to understand someone else's brain, let alone in parenting and in families where there's numerous different brain types and you're doing all of this while figuring out the diagnoses and grieving and just mm-hmm. feeling all these intense emotions.
Mm-hmm. It's super complex. And then you put on like developmental stages, right? Of like, you know, you have a child and it's your first child and you're going, wait a minute, is this normal? Is this not normal? I have no idea. And so there's just a lot swirling in a family system that has that sort of diagnoses.
Even just these elements that you're naming right now, that we're talking about right now, of loss and then the psychoeducation about the different types of brains, the developmental stages, even that is just so organizing. And to be able to put these elements, mimic that, maybe make it take it from the implicit to the explicit for a family, even for siblings. You know, I don't want to leave them out by any means, and so, or for grandparents. And how organizing would it be for the whole family system to name all these things and make the implicit mm-hmm. explicit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like their brain works differently. And let's understand this. And we're all learning. Like, it's so interesting for a child, right? Because they're learning how their brain works while the parents are sometimes learning how their brain works. And so it's this discovery. It's a lovely reframe, right? Like, ooh, we're all discovering this and that sure didn't work. So what else can we experiment? Because this part doesn't work.
Yeah, I love that experimentation mm-hmm. mindset. That's mm-hmm. helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So Kat, as you've talked about having two of your children being neurodivergent, what is that like for you as a mom to then step into an EFFT room with a family that might be also discovering something like this?
It's an interesting interplay of having an ability to use my knowing, right? Of like what may be hard, what the family may be going through, and also not have so much counter transference that I'm projecting or going too far around my own experience and making my own experience their experience. And so it's this interplay of like knowing and curiosity that's like always coming in and out.
I know I've referred couples to you, and I know you work with a lot of families who are managing these types of diagnoses. And when I talk with you, just you seem to have so much knowledge around this, obviously, because you've done a lot of your own research. Where do you see parents or families getting stuck around issues of neurodivergence in families? What are some typical blocks that kids might have or parents might have?
Emotional regulation in general, right? If I look at a child who is struggling with neurodivergence, oftentimes there's struggle with emotional dysregulation and regulatory issues. And like there is a true necessity for parents to have strong regulation. And if a parent or two or both parents have their own neurodivergence, then it's like doubly hard. Right. And so I think that that's a huge block and like a pretty big necessity to work on. How does our family know that we're dysregulated? Parents, how do you know that you're dysregulated from a couple subsystem? How do you tag in and tag out when you know that you're dysregulated so that the most responsivity can stay online? So that's a block that I see. I think just like the grief around having a child that may have struggles, right? Like I look at that of like, the deep grief that happens where you look at your kid and you're like, man, this is going to create some struggles in your life. And like, hopefully being able to see some beauty that's also existing in the neurodivergence. But that's the block. I think like organizational, structural, like just small things like that, like families need support in that way, right? Like if a child is not able to sequence, is not able to have, they have time blindness, like parents really need to know how to step in and support their child with those executive functioning strategies. And sometimes parents don't want to create codependence, or they don't want to create an entitled child, or they're coming in with beliefs about how children should be. And those can be some blocks that have to be unpacked, and some psychoeducation given around just different brain types.
Sequencing and time blindness, you said. Yeah. Tell us a bit about those. What exactly is that?
So sequencing is like, you know, let's say my 11-year-old who has ADHD is trying to get ready for school, right? And we all have a way that we get ready to go to work or to school or something. Like those levels, like those places of sequencing. Okay, first I get dressed, and then I come downstairs, and then I eat breakfast, and then I brush my teeth, and then I make sure my lunch is packed. Like children with ADHD have a hard time going from one thing to the next. And so this is where lists come in handy, or in checkoffs. And oftentimes parents have to remind children, or like go, okay, let's think, what is our checklist? Do you have you done this? Have you done this? And help them sequence. And then time blindness is, I hear this a lot with my clients, like, right, like, I told my child to go upstairs and brush their teeth, and they were upstairs for almost 20 minutes, and they don't even have their backpack ready, and we're running late. And you go upstairs and the child's just like in the bathroom, like staring at themselves in the mirror. And like, there's an essence of time blindness that can happen, of like just getting lost in your own thought and your own mind.
Oh my goodness. My 12-year-old daughter, I suspect she may have some ADD, the jury's out on that, but she will get locked in the bathroom for 10 minutes before breakfast. And then the other morning I was calling her. I'm like, Genevieve, what's going on? She says, don't worry, mom. I lost myself in my reflection in the mirror. And I was like, oh my goodness. That would be an example of time blindness, right? And so now I have to give her a limit of 2 minutes in the bathroom before breakfast, because I know that she's just sitting in there dawdling. She's losing herself. She has no understanding of the time.
But I love her, like how she made some sense of that. I just got lost in my reflection.
Very creative. And then how can you discipline a child in a moment of such creativity? You're like, wow, that was eloquent. Beautifully said. And I was laughing my head off. Help me appreciate her in that moment.
Yeah.
With your EFFT, with these kinds of families, do you end up making external referrals for psychoed? Do you recommend books? Like, what are some of your favorite go-to things to learn these kinds of skills? And
I like this question. Let's hear it.
But I love, because my brain just naturally does this stuff, and my husband's brain doesn't do it. And then he wants help from me, and I'm like, I don't know what to tell you, because my brain just does it. Yeah, right? It's really hard to break it down when you haven't had to learn it in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, there's tons of books, and I'm not good at remembering book titles, so I won't be able to regurgitate them, unfortunately. But I also really appreciate, there's this executive functioning parent coaching class where it's just all online and helping parents learn how to coach executive functioning. I can email it to you. I think it's called, it's based out of Boulder, but actually, when my son got diagnosed, it was a recommendation and I did it, and it was lovely to help with how do you coach these skills, right? Because it is very specific. And then, you know, in Boulder, this is where I practice, there are tons of executive functioning coaches and people who work specifically with ADHD. And that actually has some really nice, nice support for a child so that you're also not power struggling as a parent around if you can, if you need that extra resource of like a mentor or a coach. It's just such a different vibe than the parent engaging in that kind of coaching, especially for teens when they're trying to individuate and like not be so micromanaged by their parent, and their parent is moving more into like a consultant role in that way. That I talk about this with families, right? Like when your kids are little, like you're managing them and that is your role, right? But as they grow older, the hope is that the relationship is solidified enough that you become a consultant, that they want to come to you. But if you're still having to be this manager, it kind of can inhibit that place of becoming more of that consultant and resource for your child. And so sometimes resourcing it out to a executive functioning coach can be more helpful in that age group, in my opinion.
I just keep having these moments, Kat, in our conversations with our guest speakers where my mind just gets blown away. And it's happening right now. I'm sure you can tell. Yeah. And I just love the idea of the parent being able to stay in the parent role. Mm-hmm. And they can make that adjustment for that developmental stage in need and shift into the consultant role while still knowing that their teen most likely still needs that coaching role as well.
Right.
And so I just love that scaffolding idea. I love the adjustment for the developmental stage in need. And honestly, it's so funny because like I'd hire a tutor for my kid, no problem for school, right? Like I would, sure. Like I don't know math. Like I'm a therapist. So I would have no problem like outsourcing and resourcing my child and my family in that way. And I just am mind blown that we can do the same thing in this regard. And so I'm just smiling here in this conversation. Yeah. It gives me a lot of relief. I feel very light and hopeful. And I mm-hmm. just love that I can have this as another way to resource families who I work with as well. So thank you so much for blowing my mind.
Okay, I want to take it from hard. This is already hard and overwhelming, but let's make it even worse, okay? Right. All right. So what do you do when you've got a family that comes in where you think there's a neurodivergent piece and the family isn't aware of it, doesn't see it?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked this question. I'm okay. Edge of my seat.
They just have no idea, or they're saying like, we don't have ADHD. We don't have neurodivergence in our family.
Yeah, something like that. Like, I feel like you pick this stuff up pretty quickly. You know what to look for. And I know we've all faced, you know, couples or like one of the parents might have a block like this or a neurodivergent piece. Sometimes it's a child. I think mm-hmm. very often what I see is a parent who is maybe a little hard on a kid. Mm-hmm. And yet what the child is dealing with in one of the cases I'm thinking of was a learning disorder. I could tell that he was a good kid. He knew right from wrong. Parents were lovely, accessible, and yet they just kept getting stuck around this homework piece and follow through pieces. Mm-hmm. And eventually I made a referral and it turned out that he had a learning disorder. And mm-hmm. that cleared everything up once they got some extra support for that. But mm-hmm. those are tricky conversations, right? When we think we might be seeing something.
Yeah.
That parents might not be seeing, and how do we gently assess that and then bring that to the forefront?
Yeah, I think my favorite way is to make some assumptions around like, and not bring in any diagnoses or curiosities, but like, let's talk about how your brain works. What do you know about how your brain works? Or I'll ask the parent, like, let's talk about what you notice about how your kid such and such's brain works. What do you know? Right. So that it's taking it kind of from a stigmatized diagnoses to like, a parent, what do you understand? What do you know about your client? So it's more strength-based and more joining. And then I start talking about it in that way. Well, you know, brains all kind of work differently. And sometimes I see kids that their brain works this way. And sometimes I could see kids that their brain works this way. And I'm curious, what kind of brain do you think you have? And so I just use it as kind of a brain piece that can destigmatize.
That's a lovely suggestion. So practical. Thank you. Uh-huh. And that can really help us also talk about the negative cycle, mm-hmm. and then start tracking, oh my goodness, I think I just saw that thing about your brain. And as parent was talking to you, I saw you flick your eyes out the window, or you got a very far away look. And what's right. happening in that moment. And so if you just track it behaviorally, you're going to see whatever it is showing up in front of you real time, right?
Right.
And so there's right. no need to actually ever label that. Mm-hmm. You want to help the family members understand this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about how we as clinicians work how we in EFFT, we work in present process, right? We work in the here and now. And you know, in the old days before I was a converted EFTer, I would have pulled out that paper and pen screener. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like diagnostically, it's for me diagnostically, I just love that I have this tracking that I can do live in the moment in front of me between parent A and their kiddo, parent B and their kiddo, and the wealth of information that comes from that. To me, is not only richer, but I love what you say. It's destigmatizing, mm-hmm. Because it's not like here. See what score you get. Let's see what score you get.
Yeah.
You know, right? And yeah. So I just love me being a converted EFTer. Is like I just got to find a cue. I got to track how the parent responds, and what emotions come up with that? What is the meaning that's made? And to me, that's the best diagnostic piece I have in my toolkit as an EFTer.
Yeah, it's true.
Because at the end of the day, whether there's a diagnosis or not, our job is to help the family to communicate and understand each other mm-hmm. around all these different pieces.
Mm-hmm. Bingo. Yeah.
I do have a philosophical question though, Kat. I'm really curious, like what is it important to diagnose if there is something? I see families go two different ways these days. Like there's families who adamantly say, I know my kid has this thing. I'm not labeling it. I'm not diagnosing it. We'll just learn to live with it.
Yeah.
And then I see other families who get those assessments and diagnose and obviously get, you know, a wonderful array of services. But then also on the longitudinal sense, I have a lot of couples who are coming in like in their late 40s, 50s, and are getting diagnosed for the first time.
Yeah.
And how mind-blowing it is for them in terms of their understanding of themselves and how freeing having a label is finally. It finally helps them understand things that have been a part of that pattern for decades.
Right.
And it just makes me think, like, are we doing a disservice by not naming these things? Should we be naming them? What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I don't have one specific yes or no, right? Because you have to meet the couple or the family where they're at. I can speak to like if there is specifically like ADHD in a family system or in a couple system, it is going to impact the system regardless of what it's called. And so there is a real truth to be able to track what's going on between them and unpack their cycle and de-escalate their cycle based in the behaviors and what's going on with the said diagnosis, right? But then the other piece that I have to say is if there is a diagnosis, what happens, I think, with couples, with your example of like in their 50s, right? It's like, oh my gosh, this is what's happening and this is your brain. And then knowing what you're working with and like the compassion and understanding on both sides, like, ooh, right, I have some ways that I show up that are harder, just like we all do, right? And the neurotypical person can have a little bit more compassion and understanding of their partner and vice versa. But what I have to say about children is, you know, there is a lot of research around diagnosis and treatment around kids that, especially with ADHD, which I know much more about than ASD, being diagnosed and being treated will help your child not have depression or have less depression, less anxiety, be less at risk for substance use issues. And so there is some good research around the necessity for diagnosis and what it does for a child's self-identity and self-worth and how a child could manage that.
Oh, interesting. That's wow. Really helpful to know. And does it matter at what age that is revealed?
All I know is that if a child is treated, right? Like, because if you think about it, like a child who is bouncing off the walls, getting in trouble all the time, isn't feeling successful at school, the negative impact, right? And that they really actually cannot help themselves, right? Like their brain cannot sit.
Yeah.
Then the impact of that from a mental health standpoint, year after year after year, is very significant. So if you can have, whether it be strategies, whether it be neurofeedback, whether it be medication, like getting an IEP, getting a 504 to help support your child in becoming a learner, in understanding how their brain works, self-advocating, in figuring out how to be a learner in our very structured environment, those are all very resourcing and resilient building places versus a child who's literally in the principal's office all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my gosh, that's so important. And adding all those kinds of resources, while it can make the family life very busy, it does give the parents or caregivers other tools, right? It takes a little bit of the pressure off of them to have to do it all.
Right.
And I'm realizing just that that's such a privileged society, a country that can provide these kinds of services.
Yeah.
And then also all the countries around the world where for many decades, these things weren't ever diagnosed. And even now that they are starting to be, the resources just don't exist, which makes me so sad.
Exactly. Yeah.
Are there resources or websites or free services, or what would you recommend in less fortunate communities?
In schools, right? Like there are, I'm not so knowledgeable about this, but like if you suspect that your child is struggling, you can always request a 504 or an IEP evaluation. And I think it's different in every state, but I know in the state of Colorado, a parent's right is to request. They can deny, but always request, because our public school system does need and has not a lot of resources, unfortunately. And I would not say are they totally knowledgeable all the time about neurodivergence, but they should be able to scaffold a child. And give some sort of free resources.
Okay. You got to advocate for yourself and for your kiddo. And that also means working through the denial and working through the grief and helplessness a parent might feel initially.
Yeah.
And really finding a way to fight for them.
And you really have to advocate. I just hear this time and time again with parents. And I know my own story with my middle son with getting him diagnosed with dyslexia specifically, I fought the good fight and I'm very well resourced. And as far as having knowledge and being able to say, no, something's not right. And so I just encourage parents out there to really notice your kids, ask the questions to your teachers, watch their scores, watch their behavior charts, however they're tracking their behaviors. And if you have questions, ask and request.
Thank you for that.
As you say that, it just makes me think that, you know, for you, a well-resourced, savvy parent and mother, the look on your face when you said, I had to fight the good fight and I'm a well-resourced person, it really just made me feel the importance of the parent being resourced as they're navigating the school system or working with the administration. And in a way, like, don't we all need someone who's a quote stronger, wiser other? Yes. And we just, the hardship of feeling alone in that fight, nobody needs to be alone, right? Everyone deserves to have someone in their corner, as well as the parents.
And like, what is our responsibility or our privilege as therapists to be sometimes the stronger, other wiser for our families, of helping them at least have a resource to process like the hardship of it, to encourage, to ask good questions, and be that stronger, other wiser in our family work.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Kara, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. And as our time draws to an end, can we end up back in your family life? Yeah. Like, you are living this day to day with your kiddos. And just tell us about like one or two rituals or special words or accommodations you have in your family that work for you, if you don't mind sharing.
I have a really sweet story, if you don't mind. It's very sweet. So my 8-year-old son, who has ADHD and dyslexia, he is a special guy. He's super empathetic and a big feeler. And this is one of my favorite stories to tell about him. But in our family, one of the rules, and this is thanks to attachment theory and my work as an EFT therapist, one of our rules is no one cries alone unless they want to. And my kids know the rule, and they are always able to say, "Hey, mom, I need space." Sometimes it's not as nice. Sometimes they're like, "Get out, I don't want you," right? But if they're upset, the rule is I will always go and say, "Hey, rule is no one cries alone. Do you want me here?" And sometimes they'll say, "Yeah, I want to talk." Or sometimes they're like, can you just sit with me? Or sometimes they're like, "Get out." Because I don't think anybody should cry alone if they don't want to cry alone, especially children. And so one day I'd had a day. My oldest son accidentally broke my computer. He played a practical joke on my middle son and ruined a mattress. And like, it was like a $5,000 day. And I was just like really in a bad space. And I was in my laundry room and I was just sobbing. I was just in a moment of like, oh my God, this is so hard. Things feel so out of control. And I was like throwing the laundry in, and Max, my son, comes up and he looks at me. He's like, "Mama, are you crying?" And I was like sobbing and I was like, "I am." And he was like, "Are you okay?" And like, this is like our therapist moment, right? I'm like, no, you don't have to take care of me, right? This is what's like going through my head. And I was like, "Max, I'm okay. I've had a hard day. That's why I have tears. And like, you don't have to take care of me. I'm good. Like, go downstairs and do whatever he was doing." And he looks at me and he was like, "Mom, no one cries alone in our family." And comes up and hugs me. And I was like, it makes me cry now. It was like the most tender, sweet thing, right?
Aww.
And like this sweet moment of I didn't know like that rule would impact me in that kind of way. And we hugged and I told him that I was okay and we talked about it. But it was such an interesting experience for me to have that. Okay, I'm having a moment. We have this rule. Like, can I let empathy in from this child? It's not his responsibility to take care of me.
Yeah.
Natural,
yeah.
Right?
What a beautiful story of it sounds like a core value, like a family value that you've baked into this family DNA, so to speak. And then you get to actually stand on it. Right. And realize how deeply your children rely on it, right? That they hand it back to you in a moment that counts for you.
Yes.
Wow. What a beautiful, like, what a proud moment as a mom. Like, wow. And you got to regulate a little bit too on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
With him.
So it was a sweet moment. And I went, oh, right. Attachment. Like, he's learning this from all of those moments that I sat.
Yeah. That where there is vulnerability in your family, a comforting response is being responsive to that to that hurt, that pain, that vulnerability, and you have internalized that. You've baked it in, as Catherine said.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your knowledge and time and wisdom. We're very appreciative, Kat.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kat.
That's it for today, folks. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again for our next journey.